Excellent. Begin the same way. Anybody not have a copy of the outline? Just raise your hand real quick. We'll pass one out to you. Anyone not get the copy of the outline? Well, we're doing great. Okay, turn to chapter 11 of Romans. Romans 11, he opens up in verse 1, I say, then did God cast off his people? God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. Now keep in mind, when Paul wrote Romans, there were no chapter divisions and no verse divisions. And so what he says in chapter 11, verse 1, harks back to chapter 10, verse 21, where God always has his hand spread out to Israel, awaiting Israel's response. In a positive and not a negative way. But does that mean that in the meantime God has cast off his people? And that's the question he raises. So in chapter 9, for example, he showed God had the right to deal with Israel severely if it was necessary. In chapter 10, it shows the fact that there was such a necessity. But now in chapter 11, God is going to be moving in a special way to bring about the salvation of mankind in general, but the salvation of Israel in particular. And this is now moving from bad news to good news. And so in chapter 11, verses 1 through 10, he points out the rejection of Israel of the Messiah. It's not that God rejected Israel. The problem is Israel's rejection of the true Messiah. And in verses 1 through 10, this rejection was never complete. There have always have been Jews coming to faith. There was always a remnant of Israel. So it begins in chapter 11, verse 1, with the case of Paul. He raises the question, did God cast off his people? And again, in most English Bibles, it says, God forbid. But again, the Greek reads merely, may it never be. May it never be. And the very fact that God could not have cast off his people, he uses himself as an example. He's a Jew who became a believer. And the choice of Paul is evidence that God did not reject his people. Furthermore, it's also evidence that the Jewish rejection of the Messiah is also not total. Paul is a Jew and he is a believer. And then, in the first part of chapter 11, verse 2, he deals with the choice of God. And the relationship between God and his people, Israel, is because of foreknowledge. Keep in mind, God always knew every little detail that was going to happen. So God already knew that when the Messiah would come, he would be rejected by his own people, and that was already predicted, especially by Isaiah the prophet in chapter 49, chapter 50, and again in chapter 52, 53. And so the God foreknew what Israel would do, and therefore the very fact of his foreknowledge rules out the idea that he was casting off his people. The second part of verse 2 through verse 10, he deals with a common theme in the Hebrew Bible, the concept of the remnant. As you go through the Old Testament, especially from the time of Elijah onward, you have two Israels. You have Israel the whole, all Jews who were descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but within the larger Israel was the smaller Israel, and that was the Jews who believed what God had revealed through Moses and the prophets. And he points out that the fact that he is a Jew who believes forbids the casting away of Israel. And then he gives the example of another example besides himself as being individual. Because somebody might want to blow a whistle and say, yes, we know that you're a believer. We even have Jewish believers here in the Church of Rome. But there's just a small minority of Jews are coming to faith. Does that not somehow indicate that God has cast off his people? So he brings in the good example of Elijah. And second part of verse 2, then verse 3 and verse 4, he gives the case of Eliyahu, he gives the case of Elijah. And the point of this example is God has always had a remnant. apostasy was general, but it was not universal. And using Elijah, he points out that there gives the application of the illustration. So looking at verse 5, even so, there's the comparison, then the inference. So what was true back then is true even today. There is a remnant according to the election of grace. And that gives the standard according to which the remnant comes into existence. And he uses the Greek perfect tense. And the Greek perfect tense means an action that was completed in past time and continues into the present. So there's always been a remnant in the past, and that remnant continues to the very present. And reason is, if they could not achieve it by works, it has to come by grace. So if it comes by grace, it cannot be your works. Otherwise, it will make grace no longer grace. And grace means unmerited, unearned favor. So God will save all men in the Messiah, not only Gentiles, he also saves Jews. There will be members of Israel always coming to faith. So in his sovereignty and his sovereign freedom, God chooses to save the people he once himself freely chose. And keep in mind, the choosing of Israel wasn't made when Israel became a people. And sometimes there's a concept, here were Jews and then the Jews were out and then God chose them. He already chose the Jewish people as a people when there was only one Jew by divine appointment, and that was Abraham. And therefore, the limitation went from Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, and then from Jacob to his 12 sons. And there we have the 12 tribes originating from the 12 sons of Jacob. So these are all evidences that no matter how small the Jewish population of believers is, and in Israel and in Elijah's day representing the Northern Kingdom, there are only 7,000 Jews who are believers. There are probably a lot more than that in Judah, but I'm dealing with Israel. And Elijah was a member of the Northern Kingdom. Only 7,000 Jewish believers. And if you want to count Elijah, make it 7,001. Very small, the larger Jewish population. But even if there was only one Jew who was a believer, that one Jew becomes the evidence that God has not cast off his people. So in verse 7, he draws his logical conclusion. What then? That's the inference. That which Israel the whole sought, he obtained not, because they were pursuing their righteousness by means of following specific commandments. The Mosaic ones, which was legitimate, but also the rabbinic ones, which were illegitimate. For that which Israel the whole sought, he obtained not, but the elect obtained it. And the elect were those Jews who chose to believe. And therefore, the rest were hardened. And a good passage besides what we see in Romans 11 is 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, where he deals specifically with the remnant of Israel in his day. So now in chapter 11, verses 8 through 10, he begins to deal with specific quotations to show that the mostly Israel at the present day has been hardened. But they were hardened because of their rejection of Yeshua, of Jesus to be the Messiah, in the context of Matthew chapters 12 and 13. So in verse 8, he quotes Isaiah 29, verse 10. Isaiah 29, 10. In verses 9 and 10, he quotes Psalm 69, verses 22 and 23. Psalm 69, 22 and 23. To show that the hardening is partial, and there'll always be a remnant of Israel. Always was in the Hebrew Bible and continues to be into New Testament even after the death, resurrection, and ascension of the Messiah back into heaven. So the point of verses 1 through 10, the rejection of Israel of the Messiah is not total. There'll always be Jews who believe, no matter how small the group may be. Now, in the next segment, in chapter 11, verses 11 through 32, the rejection of Israel is not final. And he begins in verses 11 through 24 with the purpose of Israel's rejection. What was God having in his plan? And he raises a question that he will again refute. Did they stumble that they might fall? Now, at the end of chapter 9, remember, he did say Israel did stumble. But they did not stumble once and for all, irrevocably, never to rise again. So did they stumble that they might fall? What was the purpose of their falling? He says, I say then, relating back to what he just said in verse 1, he's looking at a majority that did stumble. And the majority that did stumble only opened the door for the mission, for the gospel to get out to a much larger population, which is the Gentile population. The Greek word for fall means to fall irrevocably, never to rise again. Yes, they did stumble, they did fall, but not for irrevocably, never to rise again. So to answer the question, he devotes the second part of verse 11 through verse 15. And the answer is 11b, again, in most Bibles, God forbid, again, more literally in the Greek, may it never be. May it never be. And in the next part of verse 11, in light of God's faithfulness, especially to his covenantal promises, such a thought is unthinkable. They have stumbled, but not for the purpose of falling. And in fact, in the closing part of verse 11, the stumbling of the Jews was for the benefit of Gentile salvation. So for the purpose of Gentile salvation, Israel stumbled. But now Gentile salvation has a purpose for Jewish salvation. And he begins to explain that in verses 12 through 15. So this basic fact he just stated at the end of verse 11, this fact begins to show a tremendous lesson. As in verses 12, 13, and 14, the purpose of Gentile salvation was what? To provoke the Jews to jealousy. Paul is thankful to God that God called him to do Gentile evangelism. And why is he grateful for being called to do Gentile evangelism? Was it because it's a lot easier? Or maybe a lot easier, but that's not the goal. It was for the purpose, the more Gentiles that come to faith, there'll be that many more Gentiles that will provoke the Jews to jealousy. And as a result of that provoking Jews to jealousy, that many more Jews will come to faith. About, 20, 30 years ago now, there was a group, Jews for Jesus, that set out a questionnaire among Jewish believers. One of the questions in that questionnaire is, did you believe because of a Jewish person witnessing to you or because of a Gentile witnessing to you? And the majority, a very large majority, and that includes myself, came to faith because we were provoked to jealousy by a Gentile believer. And so unbelief of Israel was ultimately for the purpose of directing Israel to faith. And the fall of Israel was directed to a future reclamation. And so Gentile salvation was to provoke Jews to jealousy. And the more Gentiles who believed, there'd be the more Jews to provoke to jealousy. What is that to say is that the church has provoked the Jews more often to anger than to jealousies, and so much of the persecution against the Jews was done what I call the three C's, the church, the cross, and Christ. And my first exposure to this individual, I was living as a child in Poland, after we moved back, my parents moved from Siberia through Russia back to Poland, which was my father's citizenship. And when the first Passover began to arrive, there was a small 3-year-old Catholic boy disappearing. And suddenly a rumor was spread by the Catholic hierarchy, a rumor they often spread before, in order for the Jews to make unleavened bread for the Passover service, they always had to have the need of the blood of a Christian to be mixed with the flour to make the bread. Shows amazing ignorance of Jewish law about the usage of blood. And as a result, the riots broke out in different parts of Poland. And once again, Jews were killed in Jesus' name. And they were led by the black robe priests and by the Polish police. And that's why my parents made an effort to try to leave Poland. And in fact, the then Israeli underground, there was no Israeli underground, it was called the Palestinian underground, but the term Palestinian applied to the Jewish population in those days. But now, with all of the confusion after the Six-Day War, the term was applied to the Arab population, no longer applied to the Jewish population. I went to Israel in 1966 to go to the Hebrew University, which is a very Jewish school, but my major was called Palestinology, because that was still a term used by the Jewish people living in the land. But things have changed as a result of the events of the Six-Day War, and so the term Palestinian today is applied to the Arab population, no longer to the Jewish population. And so he says he's clearly that God called him to do Gentile evangelism. And he firmly believed that the more Gentiles that would come to faith will provoke Jews to jealousy, and that is what occurred through much of history. But it's terminology has become a problem nowadays, because the word church does not only apply to evangelicals. You've got different groups of churches, Roman Catholicism, Greek Orthodoxy, and those two groups, you have much anti-Semitism of history, and even among Protestants, even Martin Luther. His last sermon on what should be done to the Jews of Germany, and that's for them to be expelled from Germany, the synagogues are to be destroyed, the Talmuds are to be burned to the ground. That was his last sermon. And much later, when the Lutheran Church rejected Adolf Hitler's demands, Adolf Hitler told the Lutheran pastors, "I'm only following what I was taught by Martin Luther." So that's why the three C's have this negative connotation. We always have to explain the difference between what are true believers. And even the term Christian is a problem, because the word itself, by the way, is only found three times in the New Testament, but never used by believers. So it was used by unbelievers, mocking believers. But there was still always the element of true believers that would provoke Jews to jealousy. And in the 1800s, when Jews were allowed to live outside the Jewish ghettos, they came in contact with many firm Gentile believers who were witnessing to Jews and provoked many Jews to faith. And even today, the Messianic community, no matter how large it is, the majority of us came to faith through Gentiles that provoked us to jealousy, and that is what Paul was trying to accomplish in these verses. So unbelief of Israel would promote Gentile salvation, and then Gentile salvation should promote Jewish salvation, and so it has. And in verse 15, he spells out the result in blessings for Israel. For if the casting away of Israel means reconciliation of the Gentile world, so if Israel's stumbling brought this much blessing to Gentile believers, and using a form of Jewish logic, Kalvah Homer we call it, you prove the lesser by the greater. If the Gentile believers have received this much blessing because of Israel's stumbling, how much more will the Gentiles receive when Israel comes to faith? It goes from the lesser to the greater. And he points out, it'll be means life from the dead. And he looks forward to Israel's fullness, because he knows from the content of the Hebrew Bible that there's going to be someday a national salvation of Israel, not Jews of all time. I remember when my father passed away, one of the elders of a church where I was speaking, the elder says to me, well, don't worry, because the Bible says all Jews are going to be saved anyway, so your father will end up in heaven anyway. But the promises we're about to see as we move through the passage, it doesn't mean all Jews of all time, but all Jews of a certain point of time. And a point of time we'll see in a few minutes. So if by default the Jews were to receive the gospel later on, and if the Gentiles are being blessed because of Israel's stumbling, they'll be blessed even further and greater when the Jews come to national faith. And that's backed by Isaiah 49 verses 1 through 13. If you look at Isaiah 49 verses 1 through 13, there's a special outline there. Messiah will come, he'll be rejected by his own Jewish people. As a result, the Messiah will become the light of the Gentiles for pure Gentile salvation, but in the end, Israel will accept him. And the outline of Isaiah 49 verses 1 through 13 is expanded by the same outline here in Romans 9 through 11. So we come to chapter 11, verses 16 to 24, where he gives the admonition. And he's warning to Gentiles not to be looking positively at Israel's falling, Israel's collapsing, Israel's stumbling. But he begins with an illustration in verse 16 and the principle. He says holy, and so he talks about the messianic Jewish community of his day that was separated and consecrated for God's purpose. And the olive tree is about to be described. It's not Israel per se, rather it's dealing with the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. Talks about the root and the lump, referring to Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant. And if they were set apart, all progeny and all descendants would be set apart. And the term first fruits refers to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The lump is the Jewish people. The root is Abraham, and the branches are the people. So in verse 17, notice how he develops it. Paul develops the figure of root and branches because it admits a distinction between one branch and another, and it can be applied either collectively or individually to believers and unbelievers, both Jews and Gentiles. And so the olive tree is not Israel. The olive tree represents the spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants. And furthermore, he's describing an olive tree, which is a good olive tree. But it is unnatural to graft wild olive branches into a good olive tree. That is unnatural. That's not normative. That's exactly what Paul says is happening. Normally, if you use a wild olive branch and graft it into a good olive tree, that's producing good olives. That is unnatural. And such a graft would normally be unfruitful. But the word he uses is that these Gentile branches, the wild olive branches, have been made partakers. He uses the term partaker in the Jewish-Gentile relationship. And one example is back in Ephesians 3, verses 5 and 6. Ephesians 3, verses 5 and 6. That the Gentiles have been made partakers of the blessings of the Jewish covenants. Gentile believers have been made partakers. Notice what he does not say here or there or here. He does not say the Gentiles have become takeovers of the blessings of the tree, which is the doctrine of replacement theology. They have not become takeovers. They become partakers. And so the wild olive branches have become partakers, and they've been grafted into a good olive tree. But in verses 18 to 22, he issues the warning. The basis of Gentile blessing is faith, not merit. And the emphasis is the need for continuation in exercising faith. Salvation is a one-time act once a person believes, but the blessings of the Jewish covenants are a continuous example. So Israel's failure should be a lesson to the wild olive branches, to Gentile believers. Because ultimately, the branches that God broke off can be regrafted. Now look at verse 23. Chapter 11, verse 23. And they also, if they continue not in their unbelief, shall be grafted in, for God is able to graft them in again. For if you were cut out of that which is by nature, a wild olive tree, and was grafted contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these which are the natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree? The warning is that the basis of Gentile blessing is faith, not merit. And there's the emphasis for needing, following a life of spirituality, a life of continuing in faith. And Israel's failure should be a lesson to them, because those Jews who chose not to believe are the branches which were broken off. And not all Gentiles are grafted, only the Gentiles who believed and also had eternal life were grafted into this good olive tree. But Israel's failure needs now to be a lesson for them. And so in the two verses we just read, verses 23 and 24, is the argument for a future restoration. So in verse 23, the only thing preventing Israel's restoration is unbelief. Whenever a Jew believes, he's grafted back into this good olive tree. And in verse 24, he provides the reason one should expect Israel to be restored into their own olive tree. And notice the use of the two possessive pronouns at the end of verse 24. Their own olive tree. Those which are the natural branches be grafted into their own olive tree. So just as grafting wild olive branches into a good olive tree goes contrary to nature, and yet God is doing something that went contrary to nature, by the same token, the Gentile believers need to remember they are partaking of the blessings of the tree, but they are not taking over the tree. Now, I own a car, and if I was to drive this car, say, from San Antonio to Dallas, and if you wish to ride with me, you can ride in my car from San Antonio to Dallas, but I'm still the owner of the car. And so the wild olive branches do not become owners of the tree. The tree still belongs to Israel. It belongs especially to that part of Israel that believes. So if this is Israel's tree, and the Gentiles are merely partakers, they should anticipate that time will come when the whole nation of a single generation is going to come to a national faith. And so what he promises in verses 23 and 24, he then deals with what's going to happen in the future. So verse 25, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, of this mystery, lest ye be wise in your own conceits. Now, as you look at the church history, the church has split into at least 1,000 or more different denominations around the world. And so in all the broad denominations, you have subdivisions. In this country, the largest Protestant group is the Baptist Church. We have more than one Baptist group. We have the American Baptist, the Conservative Baptist, the Southern Baptist. We have the GRB, the Grand Army of Rebellious Baptists. Some people refer to those letters, and so on. Certainly true of the brethren. You have the Plymouth Brethren, the Grace Brethren. You have the other brethren groups. There's nothing wrong with being a member of any of these brethren groups, but there is one brethren denomination the Bible forbids anyone to join. As the group he mentions in verse 25, I would not have you ignorant brethren. So be sure to never join any church called the Church of the Ignorant Brethren, because the Bible forbids it right here. What he doesn't want them to be ignorant about is two things. Number one, the hardening of Israel is partial, not total, but partial. And it's partial because there'll always be Jews coming to faith. So there's been a hardening, a partial one. Until when? Until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. The Greek word for fullness means a set number. And God has a set number he'll bring into the body of the Messiah. And when that set number is reached, that's when the rapture will occur. And all believers will be removed from the earth. So the partial hardening will continue until the full number is reached. And the second purpose in Acts 15:14, to take out from among the Gentiles a people for his name. The second purpose now is that God is doing the work of mission of evangelism on behalf of the Gentiles. And therefore the Gentile believers should not be obligated to follow the Mosaic law, but rather the law of the Messiah. They don't have to undergo circumcision, which was true before the work of the Messiah. And so two reasons, partial, because there will always be Jews coming to faith, and secondly, it is not going to be total until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And he says in verse 26, and so all Israel shall be saved. But again, this doesn't mean all Jews of all time. It does mean all Jews of a certain point of time following the fullness of the Gentiles. When the fullness is reached, the church is removed in the rapture of the church, and again God will begin to deal with Israel until all Israel will be saved. Now, as Zechariah chapter 13, verses 8 and 9 points out, in the persecutions of the Jews in the tribulation, two-thirds are going to perish, but the whole one-third that survives will all come to faith. So all Israel will be saved at that specific point of time. In the book of Hosea, chapter 5, verse 15 to chapter 6, verse 3, it'll happen the last 3 days of the tribulation, the last 3 days before the second coming. And so in verse 26, all this will be saved. In the second part of verse 26 and 27, he quotes two Isaiah passages to prove what he just affirmed. Isaiah 59, verse 20 and 21. Isaiah 59, verse 20 and 21. And chapter 27, verse 9. And in verse 28, he analyzes the truth he just stated. As touching the gospel, they're enemies for your sake. The alienation of Israel, in spite of covenantal promises, is God's way of bringing many Gentiles to himself, causing Gentiles to receive the gospel. But as touching the election, they are beloved for the Father's sake. The election is Israel's national election. And God chose Israel before there was an Israel. He chose it in Abraham. And the fathers relates it to the key covenant, Abrahamic covenant, that was not given through all 8 sons of Abraham, only one son, Isaac. Now both sons of Isaac, only one, and that is Jacob. And in the end of chapter 49 of Genesis, all 12 sons of Jacob will be the fathers of the 12 tribes of Israel. And in verse 29, he spells out the reason this has to be true, the unconditional and unchanging nature of God's promises. So in verses 30 to 32, he lays down the principle. Unbelief of Israel has given God a chance to reveal his mercy, not on the deserving, but on the undeserving. And now the Jews are on the same level as the Gentiles were, and because they're on the same level, they're also eligible for God's mercy. But the prerequisite is simply believing in the gospel message. And so God has shut up all, that he might have mercy on all. That summarizes the gospel. Not all without distinction, but all without exception. He's going to save both Jews and Gentiles. And if anyone is saved, Jew or Gentile, they're saved because of God's mercy. And he closes his 9 through 11 Israelology doctrine with a doxology in chapter 11, verses 33 to 36. In verse 33, what he has been spelling out in verses 9, 10, and 11 shows the wisdom of God, the riches of his wisdom and knowledge. His judgments are unsearchable, and that's the product of God's wisdom. His ways are impossible to track out. God has his own method of administrating the caring God of his will. And the verse 34 is rhetorical questions that prove the wisdom of God. Who has known his mind? None of us could know the full mind of God. Who has been his counselor? None of us can counsel God to see maybe he can do a better choice. In verse 35, he focuses on the divine riches. Who can give him that he should give back? In verse 36, the reason why no one can make God his debtor is because all things are of him and through him and unto him. All we can do is receive. We're not helping God out with decisions he makes. So to him be the glory forever. Amen. Let's skip over to chapter 15. And when he wrote Romans, he'd never been to the Church of Rome. He came to it later. And so he writes in verse 25 of chapter 15:25, but now I say, I go unto Jerusalem, ministering unto the saints. He cannot go to Rome right away. He wants to go to Jerusalem. And the reason he used to get to Jerusalem is in verse 26, for it had been the good pleasure of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints that were at Jerusalem. And he's been traveling among the mostly Gentile-speaking churches, mostly the Greek-speaking churches, and he has been collecting funds to give to the Church of Jerusalem, the Messianic community in Jerusalem, because they had fallen into a poverty level. And therefore, now that he's collected all of these funds from these Greek-speaking Gentile churches, the first thing he must do is go to Jerusalem now in order to present the funds to the Church of Jerusalem. Now, is this only a goodwill gesture? Is this only a way of showing Christian love, so to speak? Look at verse 27. Yea, it had been their good pleasure, and their debtors they are. And I point out that the Gentile believers are now fallen into debt. Why? For the Gentiles have been made partakers. This is the third use of that word. For the Gentiles have been made partakers of their Jewish spiritual blessings. They owe it unto them to minister unto them in material things. The prince are Gentile believers, as soon as they believe and begin to partake of spiritual blessings of the Jewish covenants, therefore Jewish spiritual blessings, they fall into debt. And you don't want to get to heaven still in debt. As a way to pay off this debt is to share materially with Jewish ministries like he was going to do with the Church of Rome. And so the obligation of, say, Jewish individuals Gentile individuals, is when they map out their missions giving, they should find a Jewish ministry to support. And local churches that have a missions budget should also find a Jewish ministry to support. If you cannot think of a good Jewish ministry to support, there's one I can highly recommend. But we won't make this self-serving. To which Jewish ministry you choose to support is between you and the Lord. But the obligation to support a Jewish ministry is right here in the text. It's an obligation, and you can determine in your own prayer life between God which Jewish ministry you would favor to support. You can even support more than one. But that's a fitting conclusion to what he's been saying in Romans 9 through 11. How much time do we have for questions?
About 5 minutes.
5 minutes. Okay, your question, raise your hand, and then wait for the mic to get to you. Who's got the mic? We're getting the mic now. The minutes are ticking away. Here it comes.
Arnold, when it made reference to the fullness of the Gentiles, you seem to imply that there was only going to be so many of us Gentiles that would be accepted. I'm assuming after that point in the national restoration, Gentiles will still have a chance to come to faith.
Yeah, that's about the church. The fullness of the Gentiles has a certain number. We don't know what the number is.
Right.
So when our full numbers reach, the church is removed, but then there'll be subsequent Gentile salvation in the tribulation after the rapture.
So then we'll become Jewish then?
You never become Jewish.
Okay, right. But it seems to imply that that's the end of Gentiles, but you're saying...
No, it doesn't imply the end of Gentiles. It's just that the completion of the church that's removed from the earth. That's what happens. But after the rapture, both the many Jews and many Gentiles will be saved. So the Gentile salvation and Jewish salvation will continue. Let's got the second question.
How do the believers after the rapture get to heaven?
How believers get to heaven after the rapture?
Yes.
Well, one way is to die. And when we die, we go right to heaven. And the other is that we go to heaven with the second coming. We establish the Messianic kingdom, and then all the Gentiles who live throughout the kingdom who are believers, and they'll get their glorified body at the end of the kingdom. Got 3 minutes.
Hi. Can you clarify where you said it says all of Israel will be saved, but you're saying it's only going to be Israelites up until that time?
Not all Jews. This is the national salvation of a certain time, and that's the time that follows the fullness of the Gentiles. So as the church is removed, God begin to work with Israel. And while in the tribulation, 2/3 of the Jewish population will die because of anti-Semitic persecutions, 1/3 survives, and that's the all Israel that will be saved. Those who survive until the last 3 days of the tribulation. 2 minutes. In the back. You can just throw it if you like.
I love how you said that when a Gentile comes alongside of a Jewish person, it provokes them to jealousy, and that's how they are brought into belief in Jesus. So what does it look like when they're jealous? Does that mean that they want to read the Bible?
Well, basically, in English we tend to use the term jealous only in one sense, negatively, but can have both a negative or positive aspect. So same. The Greek word I didn't get into, parazelao. Para means to come alongside of, and zelao is the source of the English word for zeal. And so a Gentile believer comes along a Jewish unbeliever. Then he lives such a life, but that itself doesn't save anybody, but then begins to give them a presentation of the gospel until the Jewish unbeliever finally reaches a jealousy point. What is this Gentile doing with my Jewish Messiah? And therefore become a believer himself. So most Jewish people who are Messianic Jews today came to faith not because of other Messianic Jews, but because of Gentile believers provoked them to jealousy in that way. Okay, we have time for one more question.
Whenever I speak to a Jewish person, they, for the most part, they don't want to hear it. And then they are turned off by my wanting them to come to the Lord. And they ask me not to talk about that anymore. And, I've talked to like two or three of them, uh-huh. And that's the response that I get. Do you have...
That's correct. That's the most common Jewish response. But there must be some Jews that are willing to listen and to ask questions and things of that nature. So we never in our ministry ever see myriads of Jews coming to faith. But we see bit by bit Jewish people coming to faith, not just from our ministry, but also other Jewish ministries also active in Israel, outside of Israel, and so on. So far you haven't had the fortune of being able to provoke a Jew to jealousy. But the general pattern, if you talk to Messianic Jews who already are Messianic, that they've come to faith because of Gentile believers provoking them to jealousy, and I'm one of them. Okay, our time is up, so we'll continue the next study in the next service.
We're on break.